Well, we had only, I think, 15 people total. In the course of that, there were some designers and secretaries and staff-type people, the Dahlberg and myself, plus Kirsting, the head of the department's brother, who was in charge of, I guess, modeling fabrication. And so I believe they had something like 8 clay modelers. And they so it was rather limited as to what you could do. And of course, when we got all of this work, we needed additional help. So we got the go-ahead for these projects. And so Dahlberg asked Bordenay through John Andrews for some additional help on the project. So they sent over the two designers, and I was trying to recall for sure. The one designer was Bill Wheeler, and the other designer, I'm trying to, I'd have to think a bit on it. On that one for a while. We had 4 modelers, I believe. One was John Snyder, Gil Trewick, Mitch Rucat, and I think Steve Melick. I know at various times we had people over there, and I believe Steve Melick was there at the time.
Mm-hmm. M-E-L-I-C-K?
M-E-L-E-K.
E-K.
His wife works as a guide in the museum.
Oh, yes. Right, you mentioned it.
And the other designer became one of the chiefs back here. I think a bit about that one. Anyway, so they sent those fellows over. And this was a lot of work. And of course, there were a lot of details to take care of, and somebody had to attend the meetings. So I put on all these hats, and I would coordinate all of this work. And Dahlberg was busy leading the design of the various things, various functions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very interesting period. We got an administrator in, so he started organizing the place under normal company regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And getting equipment and tools and things, other things that we might need, and starting to hire people. And of course, this became the major task during our stay there, hiring and training people and building an operation that could function without us. This is what we were told to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were back there something like the second week of July, maybe. And by the 6th of September, we had the show for this full-size model, plus the facelifts completed. And the model was shown to what they call the Vorstand, which is it's not the board of directors, it's the director level within the company that makes the decisions.
Can you spell that phrase?
Vorstand. Okay. Stands before, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And on the 6th of September, it was shown and approved. Now, this was quite a radical certainly more than evolutionary. It was a completely new design that broke trends and had many features that were unusual, not only to German cars, but to American cars as well. And some of these are things that came directly off of some of the developments that I had previously done. In other words, a while back I had shown you a cross-section of that advanced car I did when I was in advanced design that showed this seating position relative to a standard Ford at that time. Mm-hmm. Well, they talked about having curved glass, and so I gave them, you know, working off of that, I made up a full-size section for them to develop the curved glass.
And curved, which?
Side window glass.
Right.
And up until that time, the only production car that had curved glass, curved side glass, was the Chrysler Imperial, which was a rather, it wasn't a high production, it was a rather low production, very low volume. And however, the unique thing, some of the unique things about this particular design was it was not a straight line in plan view or in section through front to rear. It was a compound curve.
Mm-hmm.
There are, in surface development, you can't get a good shape with a flat line in horizontally in a curved side glass. They just don't fit together properly.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to develop a surface, and when you develop the surface, you're going to have a curve in each direction. So we had side glass that had compound curve. We had a four-door that had a hidden B-pillar. Now, I don't know whether we mentioned it before or not, but we had I had bought a Mercedes 300 sedan in 1954 because during that period of time, the American car, as far as I was concerned anyway, had gone to a very low estate, especially as far as the engineering and chassis was concerned. Brakes were poor, handling was poor, ride was poor. They just didn't function like they should. This Mercedes 300 sedan was the optimum of an automobile development.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Mercedes Gullwing was derived from the 300 sedan.
Mm.
And taking the components from that, taking the engine and modifying the engine with fuel injection and so forth. It was basically derived from the 300 sedan. Well, anyway, one of the features of that 300 sedan was a hidden B-pillar for the four-door.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the features that we had on our Towner 17M four-door was a hidden B-pillar.
How'd you hide it?
Well, it's the matter of how you develop the hinge line and the structure, but let me show you what I mean here. I have a four-door illustration here, someplace.
Can you, when you find it, can you describe it in audio terms as much as?
Yes, possible? The hidden B pillar. All you have are the two window frames showing at the B pillar.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having the window frame for the front door, the window frame for
right.
the rear door, with a pillar between.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So all you see are just those two window frames.
And ostensibly come together.
Which ostensibly come together except for the door opening portion, which is between the two.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's very, from a point of view of design, appearance design, it's a very nice detail.
Clean, yes.
Another feature.
I guess I must ask naively, where is the B-pillar?
Well, the B pillar, of course, was behind.
Okay.
The structure was behind. So it was not a pillarless construction.
Right.
It did have a a structure in there.
But much narrowed.
It was, of course, it could be as wide as those two window frames.
Right.
Because it was hidden. The headlights, John Andrews was trying to sell the idea of the sealed beam headlights. Well, they wouldn't accept these, of course, in Europe.
Why was that?
European lighting standards are at a higher level than those in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
or a different level, let's say. The U.S. standards were such that they were more generalized for driving over flat roads. European lighting requirements require you to see at either distances or brighter in close areas because of the very curving and twisting roads, the mm-hmm. smaller roads that exist over there.
Right.
You have that type of road here, but they don't pay attention to it. They think about the larger highways here. So anyway, when our model was shown and approved and for some time, very near the end of our development of this model, we always showed the two small sealed beam lights side by side, just as we had in this model that I had shown you earlier that we developed over here, the same type of thing. Except it wasn't quite that long, you know.
Was that a novel conception?
Well, they had to have that anyway because they were going to ship the car into certain countries that permitted seal beam. And they
mm-hmm.
talked about exporting that car from Germany into the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would have had to have developed it for the seal beam. I believe maybe Switzerland would. There were certain countries that would accept the seal beam.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe South Africa. I'm not real sure anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it would be developed with two types of headlights. So eventually they had to do something. Well, one of the things that I had worked on way back for the Cosmopolitan front end was...
This is the Lincoln Cosmopolitan.
The Lincoln Cosmopolitan was to take the normal big round seal beam, the 7-inch, and cut an inch off the top and cut an inch off the bottom, and to give it an oval look.
Mm-hmm.
The light that you get off of that top inch and the bottom inch is virtually lost anyway.
Oh.
And they said, you know, get away with it. So I had made a bezel and modeled that in, and it looked real nice on that Cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept going back to this other funny headlight bezel, which was really a terrible thing that they came out with in production.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had a chance to develop that one. The one I developed really looked beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, looked good
mm-hmm.
with the car. And so, basically, that's what I did with this. Kirsting, the brother of the former head of the department, and I worked together on a lot of projects. And he was a very exceptional, skilled artisan in most any materials. So I said, well, okay, we've got to do something here. And I said, we've got the double headlight, and we've got an opening for that, so we're fixed with that opening. So I said, let's take that opening, and let's make a lens that will fit that opening, and let's mm-hmm. make a reflector,
mm-hmm.
and we'll put a big oval in.
Ah, that's a delightful shape.
And so they came out with this, and...
Which TARDIS was this, the feature
61.
That? 61, which M... designation?
Well, the 17M. It came out as the new 17M. 17M
right.
replacement. They called it the P3. And development.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of this was that, of course, instead of a 7-inch reflector with the top and bottom cut off, they had something like a 10-inch.
Mm.
And you got much more light in those areas that were useful. The top and bottom was cut off, but...
So the light was concentrated in
it
the
was
areas
concentrated.
That you needed. Yeah.
So they got a better headlight.
Mm-hmm.
After that car was shown, the 6th of September, they had, Henry Ford II had scheduled a trip over there. So he came later in September. And so we had made up a nice display of this car. Of course, by that time, why, it had been templated. In fact, it had been drawn. And we made that model. No, that's right. They had to take the points from that. It was the clay model. They had to take the points from that clay model. They were making the drawing, I guess. Henry Ford came over. We made a presentation. And, of course, he liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a very unique design.
Right.
And very advanced. The thing that some people did complain about is that it did have a lot of plan view, a lot of curve in the side. So mm-hmm. the front end was not only tapering down, but it was curving in. And this was something that was unusual in that period of time. So we did... when we made what they call the final development or the mm-hmm. prove out of the drawing, we did pull the back and the front out. We did straighten it out a little bit. But Henry Ford second gave his blessing and the project went ahead. Well, interesting also is that 2 years after the approval, the 6th of September, 2 years later, it came into production in September.
Mm-hmm.
Which was a tremendous effort
yeah.
by everyone involved.
Yeah.
And it was completely new. The engine was modified. It wasn't completely new.
Mm-hmm.
The transmission, driveline, everything else was new.
Mm. Was that work done right there in Germany?
Yes. We had mentioned Chassant before. Chassant had some parts of this project. They may have done the... station wagon version.
Just spell that name again.
Yeah, here we go.
Chattau. Were they the Belgian men?
No. They're in. They're Paris.
They're Paris, right? They're French. Body fabricators.
Body design development.
Well, we can slide them later.
Yeah. They're still quite active.
Uh-huh.
A few interesting things that happened along during this time.
Mm-hmm.
We got back and we had this handful of modelers. There's so many things to do, and I wanted somebody that I could work with as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was one fellow there that was a little bit older and quite capable. And, however, he had come out of the plant and not gone to school. Most of these people had gone to ceramic school or an art and crafts type school
mm-hmm.
or had worked with a, as an apprentice with a an artist or
okay.
a sculptor, something. And, this fellow hadn't. He had come out of the plant as a metal craftsman.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of a boisterous type fellow, big, strong, and a little bit on the, I don't necessarily say crude, but, he was a George Walker type.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. When he would leave at night or go to a party, he would have on this... this big light fur-like coat, like Walker would wear,
right.
and fancy cap and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go home at night, he was dressed up like this. But anyway, so one morning I talked with him and I said, I need help. As far as fabrication was concerned, I had Miss Kirstein,
mm-hmm.
an excellent person. So I said, I need help here with taking care of all this modeling work. And I said, I'm going to leave you in charge. I'm going to lunch. And you line these people up to do these jobs. So we came back from lunch, Dahlberg and I, and all the modelers were sitting in Dahlberg's office. They wouldn't work for him. He hadn't gone to school, and they had
You had no experience, or was it just the
school? He had as much experience as they had, you know?
The snobbishness of not having a university degree.
Right.
Design school degree.
So, pedal back off of that one, you know.
Delbert gave in on that.
Well, there's no way you're going to do it. And,
with open revolt.
Yes. So, eventually, what did happen was we hired other people. The rest of the people didn't have enough experience. Mm-hmm. And they were too young, mm-hmm. and immature. And eventually, one of the people we did have there became the manager, but it took time to develop him. And the other thing that happened was that eventually we hired a man who had experience in model building. In fact, he's the fellow that put together that Daimler-Benz, Mercedes-Benz little model. Mm-hmm. Quite exceptional fellow. He was a watch repair work after he was captured and interned in Marseille mm-hmm. by apparently the Americans. And when he was a boy, he built ship models, and the German Navy saw these, and the German Navy had him build two ship models, mm-hmm. which is quite unusual, you know. When he came to Ford, he was working for a company that built paper models of various things, airplanes, I don't know, various things. And he would design these, lay them all out on paper, so you could take them apart mm-hmm. and assemble these paper pieces into a nice model.
Like origami.
Yeah. Yeah. So eventually we brought him in and trained him and made him the supervisor.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so that's what happened relative to these people that wouldn't work for this other fellow. But another thing that happened, it was a very disturbing period of time. The social upheaval, displacement of people in the East and the West, and the communist efforts, the fact that all of these German divisions had been destroyed in Russia. And German civilians, there were, I think, two ships at least coming out of the Danzig area, sunk by the Russians mm-hmm. up right. in the North Sea.
Yeah.
And some of these people had their relatives on it. I think...
good craftsmen?
Well, you know, when your family, half of your family is destroyed, mm-hmm. by something like that, it's not, and you've been raised under those conditions without enough food, without a warm place to live, this doesn't leave very quickly. And this situation existed. One of the modelers that we had hired, and I had this wooden dish that I had shown you that was painted with a scene of leaves and a butterfly and so forth.
Yeah.
This fellow had come from East Germany and brought this in, and I had developed a test or a method of determining the capability of a person to do clay modeling work.
You had a little proficiency test?
Yes. It amounted to giving the person a couple of actual pieces, like maybe a bumper guard and a door handle.
Mm-hmm.
We had a few different pieces like that.
Mm-hmm.
We give them clay and some tools and ask them to take it home and copy it and show them how to build up an armature on a board or something, and bring it back in when they are finished.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these were quite good. This fellow brought in a very good test. We hired him. And but he was very disturbed. And we went on vacation. This would have been actually in 59 when this particular incident took place. But I'll give you a few of these things.
Please do.
We went on vacation, and during the time we were gone, he went to make some sort of a couch at home. And there were some pieces of like rubber seating that they use for padding for for seats.
Yeah. And so in its infancy at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah, but they were using it at that time. And that's the type of thing I know that we used when we shipped our models to Europe. We
would
mount them on that to get a little bit of spring. But this was latex. It wasn't plastic foam, which was a difference. So he and somebody else that worked there, I think the other fellow went outside the wall. This area was all walled in with maybe a 3 meter wall. And on top of the 3 meter wall, they had pieces of glass concreted in, brick wall. He went out there after, I don't know the circumstances, somehow after work, and threw some of these pieces over the wall, and the other fellow gathered them up. Well, the guards caught them and interrogated them. And do you know Jack Eckold?
I've heard of him, yeah.
Well, at that time, Jack Eckold was our director.
Oh,
And so he landed in front of Jack Eckold, and Eckold fired him. And I came back from vacation, and here he was gone.
What was his name again?
The man's name.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to bring out the dish.
Okay.
But exceptional craftsman, just exceptional. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was devastating to the guy, of course, and he went back to East Germany.
Yeah.
Well, another incident. We had a fellow there hired in. Very nervous fellow. I don't know just what situation he had gone through anymore, but extremely nervous. And lots of times these things would happen when you go on lunch. But one of the things that we had with John Niger way back was a so-called blackboard that we had put mirrors on, so we get a longer view in a studio.
Right.
So we had this room that was, like I said, like 60 feet square, and we had this full-size model here, and we really couldn't get a good long view of that front end. We got a pretty good view of the rear, the way we had it set up, and we were doing just the one side. So we had a board that they had used there, I guess, for a drawing board. So we got mirrors, got the mirrors installed, and I told Kirsten, I said, you know, these casters are too close together, and it doesn't look stable to me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, we better do something about it. Anyway, we went to lunch, and we had this standing in front of this model, and the model was being worked in a bridge type measuring unit, which was really two separate columns.
Mm-hmm.
And these columns worked on a steel rail, and you could actuate the columns with a lever and a ratchet, ratchet gear on the rail.
Mm-hmm.
And rather heavy units, however, they were very accurate. They were made for body checking, measuring units for inspection, and they had been set up here in the studio. So these rails set up above the floor, maybe, I don't know, 200, 160, 180 millimeters, something like that. And so that when you work on the model, you'd have to step over this and step back down to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And to work on the model. And these rails ran down both sides of the model. So this particular day, shortly after we had gotten this mirror installed, like the same week, you know, like a day or two afterwards,
mm-hmm.
We went to lunch, Goldberg and I, and one of the things that they had done to sort of dress up this mirror. They had made a deep frame, which also gave this blackboard some more structure when they hung the glass on.
Mm-hmm.
A deep wood frame. And this fellow, for some reason or other, wanted to move this blackboard. So he pulls on it, and it didn't come, so he pulls on it again,
mm-hmm.
and it started to come, and it tipped over. And here's this blackboard coming down mm-hmm. with this deep frame right towards his chest.
Good heavens.
And of course it knocks him down, or he slips and falls down. At that time he's trying to stop it, which he can't.
Mm-hmm.
And it falls. Well, maybe this track, maybe it was 200 millimeters. I suppose it was. Which is about the depth of your chest. He falls down on the floor, sort of next to this rail, and this mirror, and you know, that was like 16 feet long, falls down with this frame hitting. At the time we had developed this advanced tractor model in 3/8 scale.
Oh yes, uh-huh.
We had also developed this whole just advanced theme model. And a long, thin fin started at the front fender and ran to the rear.
Mm-hmm.
Climbing fin, which back in that day I suppose was rather unusual. This is what the lines are all climbing now.
The wedge shape is quite modern today, too.
Right, but we also had an oval theme.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we went to full size, and of course this really doesn't look a lot like that model, except that we had picked up this theme, this indentation on the side.
Can you explain where that goes?
Well, it starts from the center of the headlight and climbs as an undercut below and a roll above. And as it passes through the center of the body, it starts to fall, and it falls so that and returns in an ellipse just in front of the rear bumper. So mm-hmm. it's an oval that is falling, a line that is falling and forms an oval at the rear.
Mm-hmm.
It also had a fin starting off of the front fender, similar to this scale, this 3/8 model.
Right.
And went back, rising slightly as it went, not as extreme as the other one, so that it was ending with a slight climb or almost horizontal as it reached the end, with the taillight built into the end of the fin.
Mm-hmm.
It was a normal sedan in that it had a normal deck lid. The opposite side, we put a aluminum mirror in the center. The opposite side of the model had a fastback, which mm-hmm. was not as interesting. One of the features of this, however, this left side of the model, it did not have this oval line either. It had mm-hmm. a different side treatment. Fin building up from the side sculpturing and climbing all the way through and forming a V at the rear. And the end of the V was the taillight. And this eventually was the theme that was used on the Mercury. Tell me, the Mercury
Turnpike Cruiser?
No,
that come earlier.
The Mercury. It was the counterpart of the Falcon. But interestingly, that's where it came from.
Hmm. That almost looks as if it might have had a spoiler effect too, if it'd been carried across the.
Well, it would have.
Yeah.
It probably would have been good for aerodynamics.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
The front of this, we had double headlights, and the hood dropped quite nicely, rounded off the front to a crease at the center of the headlights, and then returned slightly with a a grill texture pattern going all the way across below, and split bumper, and a nice skirt below the bumper, forming a enclosure back underneath the vehicle. So it was a rather fresh look at that time. You have to remember this is
very
spring
fresh.
Of, it's probably January or February of 1958. Yeah, February 6, 58.
How did that translate into the finished model, the finished vehicle?
Well, of course, it was never went into production.
Never went into production.
It was called the Debonair.
The Debonair.
But that theme was one of the things from that was evolved onto this Taunus. And of course, John Andrews liked this, and so he asked Wes Dahlberg to go over and head up design. And of course, then in turn, Wes wanted me to go with him to help him set it up, because I had worked with him for several years on various things. We worked together on the 12M, and we worked together on this the French Ford, which I told you about, which I sort of took over and carried through until they got interested again. And so that's how Wes and I got to Germany, through the request from John Andrews. So I landed over there and got checked in and went out to their design studio. But where they had the design studio was in a little experimental engineering building, or the end of the building. And this was an old, very old building. It had been there for, I don't know, 100 years, I don't know, maybe not that long. But they had a small oval test track that went around the area, so they could, their initial build-ups, they could test on the track. Out front, they had a rather large building where they had engineering offices and where they did engineering. And this had been, during the war, this had been used in the development and I guess maybe manufacture of one of these coke burning fuel gas generators that they would mount on the back of an automobile. You put coke in it, and you start the thing going, you know, and this would make a gas that you could run into your engine to run the car, since they didn't have much gasoline. But, so we had a room, we had three rooms. We had an office area, and a room where an engineer was, and we did some drafting, and then we had a model room, and the model room, well, I suppose it was something like this room. It was 40 feet, could have been like 40 feet square, and a little bit more than that, let's say 60 feet square. And they had underway, they had some 3/8 scale models, I think maybe three of them. And this Andy Rogheb was working on one. Yeah, take that back, they had two models. Andy was working on one, and Wes Dahlberg was working on one. And Andy had, had put in some interesting things. They had done some interesting developments. Well, soon after I arrived there, we developed two finished 3/8 scale models. I guess they were 3/8. And presented them, and they took from this theme, these theme cars that I had shown you, and the one in particular, the one model had this type of a long fin, or you know, like here. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't like fins. Mm. However, the model was interesting, and they wanted to have another show. So the way Dahlberg and I would work, he would work in clay too. He'd make sketches, and he would work in clay, and he'd maybe be working on the front end, and I'd work on the rear end, and we'd switch ends. He would have something roughed in, and I would go out with him to clean it up, and we worked back and forth this way. But so we had this show, and we had these big fins. They didn't like the fin. I said, well, I'm going to take care of the fin. I know what to do. And so I basically all I did was just cut it away. Mm. And we left a plateau where the fin had been. And so we ended up with this design. And they made quite an advertising effect out of this oval, mm-hmm. because the car has or had the feeling of this oval. These illustrations maybe aren't the best, but this was almost the line.
Mm. The fluid lines of functional beauty. Yes. And this is the Taunus 17M.
17M for 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I was there for, I guess, about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we completed and got approval for this particular design, the 3/8 scale.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Andy Roghebb had worked on this also, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, by that time, Kirsting was paid off and was gone.
Mm-hmm.
Also, during that first period of time, about the same time that I arrived, Bonson was hired. Bonson had been working as a clothing style window decorator.
Really? Can you spell his full name for
him? Uwe. U-W-E, Bonson, B-A-H-N-S-E-N, I think it is. And, but he, quite a good artist,
mm-hmm.
and prolific at making sketches, you know,
mm-hmm.
and a good sense of line and form, and a good sense of color, and he knew fabrics. Of course, this was something that they really needed help on over there.
What was he hired for, or as?
Well, as a designer in interiors, basically, to begin
right.
with. And, of course, Wes, he spoke good English, and so Wes depended a lot on him.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And so he quickly filled into other positions, and eventually filled in the position of executive designer executive of all design. He had all of design, I had all of modeling and fabrication, and
mm-hmm.
These things, so we were somewhat similar organizational level from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But the things with Andy Roghebb, you know, he had ambitions, and he never got along very well with Dahlberg.
Mm.
And eventually he more or less got froze out. They developed a special task for him to do, some various studies that he was doing, but you know, it was sort of a temporary thing, and eventually he left.
Mm.
But he really had a hand in the initial development of these models. And of course, never got any credit for it, which was not too good.
Yeah.
Trying to put this together. I guess the design criteria Andrews had set down, and he was good at this, determining what the vehicle should be and the effect it should have, not necessarily what it should look like, but you know, he had a few ideas of what he would like to see, and but size, package, all of the engineering requirements as far as weight, speed, and then aerodynamics, drag factor, and the gearing. He wanted a transmission that when you shift it felt like a hot knife and butter, is what he'd say.
Yeah.
And you know, eventually all of these things happened.
Mm-hmm.
They put it together.
Yeah.
The plant was small enough that when you'd hold a meeting, you'd have the heads of everybody in the organization there. And since I had been involved in so wide a variety of things, I would usually represent Dahlberg in most of these meetings. If he wasn't there, I would be there. And sometimes he would also be there. He didn't like meetings. And since I had established timing and gone through those developments back and forth, design center and budget development, and I had always followed the surface layout, so I followed all of the engineering surface layout work. So I sat on these three committees, and so there was always something going on. So if you had a problem in manufacturing, it would always come up at this meeting, but everybody would be there and they would talk it through, and maybe after the meeting, why, everybody would come back to design and you'd work the problem out right there, you know.
A unified approach rather than a segmented approach.
Yes.
Yeah.
It really was. Mm-hmm. But, so in 6 weeks, we had this 3/8 scale model design completed, and left a directive to blow this up full size and to make a full size frame. We talked about how to do this, to make a full size model, a full size armature. And Wes and I came back to get our families.
Mm-hmm. They had not come with you yet?
No.
You were paving the way.
Right. So in the meantime, my families had continued taking Berlitz, and the wives had anyway. And children, everybody had gotten all of their shots, you know, a series of them, and gone through this period of development, preparing to go overseas. We had to make arrangements to have somebody take care of the house.
Oh, yeah.
So that had been done. Everything was packed up and loaded up to be shipped overseas, stripped the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came back, my...
matter if I sit in?
I guess we had a few days here, maybe like a week.
Mm-hmm.
And we had reservations over in Dearborn Inn, so we stayed there for a week while we were doing the final things.
Right.
And so then we left as a family back to New York, and had reservations on the United States.
Oh, yeah.
And I had started to tell you about the fact that in New York, Ford must have been in national office, would handle the transits, people coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And I forgot about this. Wife mentioned this last night. For some reason or other, our tickets didn't come, or the tickets were here and didn't get into our hands And so when we went on board the United States, why, the Ford representative from Ford took us on, you know, and took us in and clarified what the problem was, and so that we got on without the tickets. And Dahlbergs were on the same ship. And an interesting note about that was that when Wes had gone to Germany, had a going away party for him in this house. The house was new, and so we had sort of a housewarming with everybody from the studio.
Oh,
the studio was breaking up, you know. And so we celebrated his going to Germany. My wife always laughed about the fact that we went with him on the same ship. So we went to Le Havre. Got off at Le Havre, took the ship in, took the train, boat train into Paris, stayed overnight, and then went on into Cologne, and we really, it's called the Königsfürst Park Hotel, Königsfürst, it's King's Forest Park Hotel. It was out out in the country, a nice, sort of quiet place, you know, across the river from Cologne. And all of the Ford families were there, except for Andrews, except for two or three who had their homes by then. And but there were still about, I guess, at least 10 Ford families that were there at that particular time. And one of the problems, of course, was trying to find homes for the Ford families. And they were hard to come by because mostly they were apartments. And there weren't many apartments because of people moving in. They were building up their production capacity, or attempting to. And so many places had been bombed out, so there was new construction. And so they had a department that would searching for places for us. So like twice a week, why, we'd go out and look at houses and go skirting around the countryside there, wherever they might have found something in the meantime. And during that 6 week period while I was there, Wes found a house that was up the Rhine about, maybe 30 kilometers, 20, 25 kilometers, something like this, right on the Rhine. And this was a nice spot, a nice view out over the river. And you watched the boats move back and forth.
Yes.
Well, the last week, they found a house outside of Bad Godesberg, which is south of Bonn, which is south of Cologne, and a village outside in the countryside of Bad Godesberg was known as, the name was Pesch, P-E-C-H, and it was a little farming community, and a man who had a family had started a house, and he had had a heart attack and died. And this house was standing, you know, construction was standing dormant. So it seemed like a nice spot. There was another Ford family that lived just across the way from where this was, a fellow by the name of Bill Bright, who was the chief body engineer and American. And they had been there for over some time. So we agreed to take that. So what happened, the company took this over to finish. And I guess they, I'm not sure just how they did it. I guess they forwarded money to the son of the owner and his wife and the family, and oversaw construction of this, completion of it. And they had a timetable of, I guess, 3 months. So we were in the hotel then for 3 months until this house was finished. How much time we have here?
A little more, huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, we lived in the hotel during a rather cold summer and rainy, and so it was not the best of time, you know.
Kids got into school?
Yes, school started during that period of time, so they had a bus, and a real nice fellow that drove the bus, a German. He spoke some English, you know. And they'd come there at the hotel and pick up. Of course, the bus was a Ford Transit, a wagon.
Oh, yeah.
And the school was in Bad Godesberg, American School of the Rhine. So he would bus them and pick up others as he went along, you know, also. And I know a couple things of interest there. Our oldest boy, it was damp and cold, and he got bronchitis in the hotel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He had to get medicine and a doctor, and the kids got in trouble once, and some of the kids, not ours, but somebody started a little fire, you know. All sorts of things going on. Tim was one of the younger ones, and he was 4. And he would always have a good time with these waiters. They would play with him, you know. They had a dumb waiter to carry trays up and down. And they would stick him in this dumb waiter from the kitchen or the basement and run him upstairs. But it was an interesting time. So anyway, we got out of the hotel into our house. And this was something like 52 kilometers away, or 38 miles, something like this. And it would take me, at that time, when we first moved there, about a good 50 minutes. And at night, maybe an hour, 50 minutes in the morning. We first moved in, we didn't have a phone. Of course, I was working all sorts of hours. My wife was there alone, or she had a car, and she had to take the kids to school and back.
Mm.
But it was a very difficult time, because she didn't speak any German fluently. Nobody in the neighborhood spoke English.
Mm.
And she couldn't communicate with anyone right there. She, of course, would go into the school, and they had, it was American school, and we had been going to the American church, which was there. This was the area that Eisenhower had built up for the occupation troops. And the American embassy was in the area. But, so they had a bookstore, and the church and the school. These were sort of the things that we would, were able to use. But, so finally, they came out to install the telephone. And the way that they install phones over there is that they have a pole of maybe, a meter and a half high, a metal pole, which has a base on it that attaches to the house, to the roof of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so the man to install the phone and the pole and the line brings the pole out on his bicycle. And this is the way it's done. So they run the line from house to house instead of pole to pole. And a lot of things they do are they make real sense.
They're using DC?
They used DC current also,
yeah, right.
But they didn't have any wires sticking up in there. They didn't have poles up in there, you know. Everything was clean.
Hmm.
And they would have boxes coming up where they had to control it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, lots of respect. Things in Europe are far more advanced than they are here.
Yeah.
The their electrical system outlets and plugs and these sorts of things are, they really work. They put a plug in a socket, it stays, it's not going to fall out.
Right.
But anyway, these are the sorts of things you have to get used to.
I'm sure very quickly you got, you adjusted fairly quickly.
Well, it was difficult for my wife.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
She was out there on her own, more or less, you know. And to me, well, it didn't make too much difference.
You commuted into the studios then at in Cologne.
Yes. John Andrews was very sympathetic because, you know, he had lived in Europe and Germany before the war.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife, and he and his family in South America, and then he and his family moved back to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so he always stressed that it was most important to take care of your family first.
Right.
Get it settled. Settled.
You'll be more productive and more
intent
worker.
Yeah. He was very understanding in many respects. Well, so we started this full-size model. I got back, and they had it ready to go. We had clay. I guess they got a new shipment of clay.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the full-size model. And we got some help. From Dearborn. When did they come?
Was the liaison pretty close in those days still?
No.
Between Dearborn and Cologne?
No. No, they didn't want it.
No, right. I know you didn't want it.
Which was the, I guess you say that was the good thing, you know.
Mm-hmm. They decided to let you alone this time.
There it is.
The new Falcon?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Bob, what was the counterpart of the Falcon and the Mercury?
Comet.
Comet.
Of course.
The Comet had those taillights. And that was on this model.
Mm-hmm.
They sent over four modelers to help us with the... I think two designers and four modelers
mm-hmm.
to help us... build up this model for show.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, we were doing two facelifts. We did a facelift on the 12M and the 15M, and also one on the 17M.
Mm-hmm.
So we did grills and roofs and backlights and freshen up the design on those facelifts. And then we did this.